Michael McCusker is with family for the holidays. The following is an encore presentation of A Story Told.
My name is Michael McCusker. I'd like to dedicate this program to Frances Cook, whom I helped nurse till she died just recently of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And a part of the reason I want to dedicate the program to her is that she was kicked out of the Air Force for being gay after a year. And if she'd lived just a couple of days more, she would have seen the Senate more or less open up gays in the military. And it might have given her a sense of well-being. So I do dedicate this program to Frances Cook. She celebrated her 71st birthday on Thanksgiving Day this year. I would like to start with some stuff that I have read before, my annual Christmas program. I'd like to start with O Come All Ye Faithful, and I should give the disclaimer that this is my opinion and perhaps my opinion in the entire cosmos. O Come All Ye Faithful. Christmas, that pagan holiday appropriated from the followers of Odin, is a time for feast and fellowship, a convivial warmth against the cold winter ahead. It is a parochial celebration that affirms a civic Christianity as the national religion, although the nation is the uneasy host for every conceivable form of theology. Usually the public piety is casual, indifferently observed, but occasionally the Puritan past clamors for power, generally during periods of disruption and confusion, such as the present, when theolytical ideologies imprint a grim, intolerant, and despotic orthodoxy upon constitutional law. It might yet be difficult to accept willful ignorance and evangelical vengeance as the center of political direction and intellectual discourse, but the anguish that underlies American culture is a schizophrenia unable to resolve material greed with spiritual piety. The political tolerance for a variety of religions that is assured in the nation's laws is probably due more to an awareness that no one sect has been powerful enough to rule over the others. And just to be sure, religion is not allowed to directly interfere with government except as inspiration and manifest destiny. The practical consequence of separation of church and state has been to protect each from the other. By its own law, the government cannot and should not enforce or impose any manner of worship or religion upon its citizens or any others who live in this country. It cannot attempt to regulate or interfere with religion or with anyone's choice of worship or choice not to. The current debate about church and state is less about religion than it is a dichotomy of political values between those who would impose a narrow doctrine of absolutes that are not to be questioned or resisted, only obeyed, and those who believe that everyone has the right and obligation to choose their own beliefs about what is right and wrong. If the United States adopted or was forced to accept a single religion distinct from a loosely defined public creed, other religions would be purged, in particular those that are not Christian. Races other than white would lose all of their already minimal civil rights. Women would be shoved back into second-class status, and most democratic freedoms would soon be suspended. The course of the current intrusion into politics by the religious right is less to glorify God than to manipulate religion as a conduit to political power and conversion of the government into a militant theocracy. If the religious conservatives who are clamoring for absolute control of the government succeed in changing the nation into an ecclesiastical state, the result would be perpetual inquisition and religious war. As precarious and brief as has been the history of political liberty, its only real opponent is the people's belief in a divine deity and their fear they might be immortal. Religion serves as handmaiden to political rule. From the beginning of history, humanity has evolved religions to explain life and its possible place within it, and always there has been the desire that life not end at the crypt. Religion has thus been a political instrument in every society, at once a source of philosophical inquiry and a political doctrine of identity and rule. By the very nature of the fear that produced it, religion is authoritarian and exacts servitude from its followers. The hope for life after life has served secular government. The misery of life can be borne steadfastly and in service to life's oppressors by the promise of rewards beyond earthly life, which it is not necessary to prove. The dilemma of where we rank in the cosmos has been narrowed considerably to serve the ambitions of a very few who paradoxically seem to reap all earthly rewards for the pious suppression of their followers and subjects. It is double-edged. The use of religion for purposes of rule makes it essential to both regulate religion and inflict its doctrines upon government. The state supplants God, but belief in God is necessary to support the state. Nationalism is itself a virulent form of religion, but its major disadvantage is that it cannot promise life after death. Great masses of citizens believe that the nation is an extension of divine rule, however, or is an acceptable substitute. They proclaim the same fervor toward a flag as towards a deity and often confuse them. American religious conservatives used to think the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, righteously denounced as the evil empire, was the classical final confrontation between good and evil, and would, through the use of nuclear weapons, result in the end of Earth. Now they find other apocalyptic struggles between God, anti-God, once again crusading against Islam, reminiscent of the advent of the first millennium, while simultaneously focusing culturally inward at gay people, assertive women, and third world immigrants who transport alien gods to these shores. The Christian conservative backlash is not simply the perception of the disintegration of society as the result of the deterioration of spiritual values, but what they also perceive as a war against religion by the government, which in reality generally accommodates religious beliefs unless arguments against them are compelling. Religious fundamentalists are rarely accommodating, but instead exhibit malevolent contempt for dissent and refuse to accept that people who think differently might be sincere and even noble in their points of view. True believers put a rather low priority on mortal life, which is only a process of mortification and putrescence to the faithful. They profess a distaste for life and its pleasures and pains. They despise what is known as humanism, which is simply an ethical and compassionate responsibility for being human, but which is reviled as permissive heresy. They believe that all who claim to be Christian must support every activity that fulfills biblical prophecy, even if it destroys the rest of us. This, of course, would be the desired Armageddon and selection of souls, the so-called rapture. Good and evil would both be destroyed with the end of earth, but good would return with the reappearance of Jesus Christ. Earth would be resurrected and repopulated with the souls of the faithful, who would dwell for eternity in the joy they eschewed in life. Everyone would have to die first, and everything Homo civilis has spent millennia to construct. It is ironic that the most grim, unbending, intolerant, and ignorant are unshakably certain that only they are beloved by God. It is perhaps more ironic that one would have to willfully participate in the murder of life to be worthy of living forever. Most religions are preoccupied with death. With shades and shadows, and with few exceptions, they share apocalyptic visions of the end of earth. A wonderful yearning of spirit and intellect is distorted into oppressive sets of scriptures that stifle the inquiry that originated religions. Questions are bent into rigid answers that must not be questioned. All religions demand their followers suspend the progress of knowledge and that nothing pertaining to theological doctrine be advanced beyond the period in which a particular religion was founded. Mythologies developed hundreds or thousands of years ago are taught as absolute certainties, and subsequent learning is dismissed as heretical. A distinction must be made between religion and spirituality. An atheist can be profoundly spiritual, while a religious follower might only be so because of social pressures, ambition, or as a result of fear, which is a greater draw to the pew than the boilerplated love of God. One does not have to prostrate before a disinterested deity to be moral. Morality is the conscience of humanistic behavior. In that sense, most religions have seldom acted morally, and in this millennial era of inquisitionary fervor, the political intent of religion is immoral. The issue of church and state is much more serious than the tiresome ambitions and subversions of zealots and despots. Separation of church and state embodies all other disputes, ethnic, religious, racial, and gender, which have resulted in civil wars elsewhere in the world, but are so far contained within the normal but very strained framework of American politics. Yet the middle ground of civility and reasonability is disappearing. Comparable to the slavery issue, no matter how many compromises are erected to stall or slow the outbreak of civil war, the confrontation between religious or secular dominance of the government seems to inevitably await solution in suppression and corruption of the democratic process, and perhaps ultimately in violence. Deep religious beliefs are at their core a very human desire to exist in harmony without cant or hypocrisy. Religion, like music, has the power to bring us together despite our differences. But for most of history, it has been utilized to separate us and ensures that the majority of humanity is perpetually at war with itself. We live at a time when the incredible pace of knowledge might liberate us from idolatry and specicide, but instead we use what we have learned to terrify and threaten ourselves with extinction, and as a consequence retreat into psychopathic regression. We shield ourselves with fairy tales constructed during epochs when Earth was thought to be the center of everything but heaven and hell, and which we should have jettisoned with our historical adolescence. We seem unable to respond maturely to our diminished status in the universe or to understand that our religions and gods do not adequately address the real situation of perishable life or the birth and death of stars far beyond our reach. We would destroy all that we have built and all we are rather than change ourselves into what we might be. That is the real tragedy of clinging to superstitions we have outgrown. And now I'd like to read something else I wrote, Born to be a Rebel. It starts off with a quote by Jesus of Nazareth. Blessed are you poor, you that hunger, you that weep. The claim is that a baby was born 2 millennia ago without benefit of sexual intercourse, which must have severely tried the faith of the father and perhaps greatly surprised the mother. No one is absolutely certain when the infant appeared in a stable among farm animals, his temporarily homeless parents and, Old Testament say, angels and other celestials. The baby was proclaimed the Son of God by 3 travelers from the East known ever afterward as wise men, magi, although in his lifetime none of the world's religions recognized him as blood or spiritual kin to any of their deities. He had no brothers or sisters who were known about, this is disputed, and he seems to have been encouraged in his own omnipotence as only children often are. Not much is known about the child's early life until he reached 30. Like his father, or the earth person who seems to have resignedly accepted his paternal role, he became a carpenter. Only one incident of his childhood is chronicled. He is said to have ejected a few avaricious money changers from a temple, which betrays an early example of his essential naivete. He emerged from obscurity when he was 30, and until his death 3 years later, he roamed around preaching radicalism, sedition, and revolution. He was unusually popular among the impoverished and discontented, attracting followers of homeless and unemployed, mentally unstable and physically disabled, sexually and politically deviant, and other assorted pariahs. He eventually came to the attention of authorities who were greatly concerned about his disruptive effect upon the lower classes. A paid informer from his inner circle, called apostles, betrayed him and he was executed after an inconclusive trial. His place in history and myth is principally as a religious figure. However, a significant number of scholars challenge that he was the son of any but a humble carpenter. They claim he was a political activist, specifically a labor organizer in an era when workers had absolutely no political or personal rights or liberties. These revisionists refute that he was executed for religious preaching. As even contemporary times show, religious radicals and cult founders can be tolerated within a society, while labor agitators are frequently imprisoned or murdered. His execution is often cited as evidence of this theory. He was crucified on a cross, which was the normal method for dispatching criminals and enemies of the state, replaced in later periods by the gibbet and electric chair. However, nails were driven into his hands and feet instead of suspending him by the usual rope bindings. The specific use of nails is proof enough, the revisionists insist, that he was arrested and executed for his attempts to organize carpenters and others of the working class in what would later be known as a labor union, and that he had no intention of founding a religion. Some of his later followers, though adherents of him as Son of God, have acknowledged that he antagonized the law and order establishment of his day. They admit, in the words of a few, that he attacked, quote, the very roots of his society, unquote, and that, quote again, he was a problem to his mother and to his entire generation. He was the most radical leader who ever lived, a 20th century disciple has written. Although the revolutionary nature of his preaching caused his execution, his later proselytes adopted the status quo to their creed, which ultimately became its most effective instrument of perpetuation. By structuring a theory on the claim that he was the Son of God, his successors enjoyed an advantage most temporal systems lack and religions enjoy. They did not have to deliver on their promises. Indeed, for three millennia they have kept their flocks docile with extravagant suggestions of everlasting life beyond the grave of the flesh, which surpasses anything secular organizations can offer. And the sweetest part is they don't have to prove any of it. And to correct myself, it's actually been two millennia. We are now entering into the third. The first generation of his disciples eagerly martyred themselves, incidentally providing immensely popular spectacles for mass audiences while supplying abundant food for circus animals. The farther west succeeding generations moved the center of their expanding religion, the increasingly lighter his skin and hair in evocations of his image, and his radical ardor was softened to a benign, implicitly feminine expression. He is called the Prince of Peace, yet in his name his followers have warred incessantly against peoples of differing beliefs and against each other as sects rise and claim themselves his only true disciples. In his name, genocide was waged against the original inhabitants of the Americas, and Europe was made a cemetery in the name of Reformation, 1,700 years after his death. In the most grotesque excess of theology, a bizarre, vengeful sect that confused him with grim ancient gods he displaced almost succeeded in exterminating the religion of his parents, which had refused to accept him as a long-awaited Messiah 2,000 years before. His presence might be useful again, but not in the scenario of Armageddon some of his more fervent disciples yearned for. Nor would it help if he, or she, posed as a Messiah, Buddha, or Guru. Humanity, as it has so often before, could use a few good prophets, revolutionaries armed with visions instead of weapons and hatreds. Unfortunately, false prophets emerge in unsettled periods who create great mischief and misery, whose violent and vengeful ambitions obscure quantum visions of universal suffrage and prosperity. Perhaps it is time to re-examine his real message to humanity. Instead of a Son of God predestined to die, to defer human responsibility for its sins of greed, rapacity, and butchery, we have an ordinary carpenter who, for reasons that have been lost due to his deification, felt compelled to fight the slavery and injustices of his era and attempted to raise up the poor and disenfranchised into a powerful force of revolution. If that is what he was, then he did not die to save our souls. He lived to make us free and was put to death for that heresy. And that was Born to be Free. And I wrote it, and I'd like to continue on with something else I wrote, The Peace Cardinal. And again, the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, continues. A dark, thin, intense figure cloaked in the color of blood, his long hands the pale white of the heavenly host raised in blessing, the bulging eyes popped from faces of shock, walked down the long carpet of history toward a railed altar in the beginning of his church. In those long-ago ghostly dust-cracked days of repression, when the first hairy unbathed Christians were the Sunday afternoon entertainment for the predecessors of today's sports crowd, the frightened followers of the martyr bravely took their gospels to the streets, acting out their satires and truths in a theater of reality aptly called, in a name that has survived the centuries and subsequent snowballing tyrannies, guerrilla theater. And His Eminence, Gregoria Cardinelli Chianti, known also as the Pope of Peace, aka Frenchie, linked himself to the historic chain and walked his lonely walk down the crimson carpet of Precious Blood Catholic Church, followed by the unseen phantoms of centuries desiccated wild-eyed men and women of mercy and peace. Startled faces came awake with the crispy passage, and a quiet murmur began to fill the church, the walls of which hid the sun except through mosaic glass windows. A speechless priest watched in dumbfounded amazement as he was blessed by the strange apparition clad in robes of a cardinal, a huge crucifix, green, scarred by time, chained to his neck, who turned and in a fast, strong voice, cracking with emotion and fear of his act, called the church a false church, and the thousand of the faithful couldn't believe what was happening before their own eyes. Nothing, absolutely nothing, had prepared them for this vision, or, if you will, for it truly was, this miracle, this triumph of the soul. It was the first Sunday of Advent, 2 millennia after the birth of the man God who once accosted the Templars in their once hallowed halls, in a time of grotesque perversion similar to this, and how many have done it since. It was almost time for communion. The tired priest was winding up his windy sermon to the bored faithful who were fidgeting at this most laconic time of the Mass, waiting for this thing to end so they could get back to the real Sunday ritual of football and beer. In the vestibule, unseen, regaled in the ancient robes redder than a raspberry popsicle, stood His Eminence Gregoria Cardinelli Chianti. It was the first Sunday of Advent, that time of prayer before the coming of the Prince of Peace. "As Catholics, we have entered into the full week prior to the Christmas of Advent," the priest said from the pulpit. Funny how all those faces look alike, smug, gray almost, except for the women, painted in gaudy colors, renegades of nature where the general rule calls for the males to strut the plumage to whatever churches birds and lions attend. Quiet, average, sleepy, God-fearing believers, tight with their nickels when the baskets were passed. "I ask you for your prayers for peace and alms for peace," asked the priest, who was actually a bishop. His next words, choked in his throat, an agony of shock popped his eyes and dropped the gate of his jaw. The sleeping faithful stirred, awakened, and mirrored their priest. Gregoria Cardinelli Chianti had emerged from the vestibule. He walked the altar, blessing the throng. He stopped, genuflected before the huge crucifix suspended dead center over the altar, rose and passed his blessings in a graceful sweep of his pale white hand to the priest bishop. He then faced the startled congregation and, in a voice ringing through out the huge cavern, shouted, "Hypocrisy, false doctrines, false truths. How can we pray for peace and give alms for peace when the peoples of the world are engaged in domestic wars and international wars? How can we also pray for peace and give alms for peace when the Pope himself refuses to intervene in wars and the causes of wars, poverty, ignorance, intolerance, and greed? We are to fight ourselves for the true preservation of peace and love and not listen to false words. How can we fight for peace when the church itself is splitting into many factions over the controversy of that beautiful birth control pill and abortion?" That was when the cops came. They poured in through the front of Precious Blood Catholic Church, the rear and the windows, rushing the poor lonely figure standing now silent with his hands clasped. Frenchie's name in real life is Robert Giglio, and wits like to call him Gigolo. He was once to be a priest and spent 3 years in a seminary. He abandoned the cloth because he was abhorred by the hypocrisy. His name of Gregoria Cardinelli Chianti means simply Gregorian chant. He sings out for peace. Hustled out of the Church of Precious Blood in a bum's rush by the brethren of the beloved Keystone Cops, he was surrounded by angry faces in blue uniforms demanding his identification. Frenchie reached into his robes and brought out his baptismal certificate. "As a true confirmed believer of Christ," said His Eminence, "this is all the identification I need." "Are you queer?" righteously asked one of the upholders of all that is good and decent in America. "I am queer for Christ," the Cardinal of the Street smiled beatifically. He was trundled into a patrol car to police headquarters, where the gendarmes badgered him with questions. "Can I have a chair?" Frenchy asked. After a while, then a sitting cop kicked one over to him. "Oh, blessed Lord," he prayed, "bless this chair for this weary body, and bless these policemen who have been so kind in giving me this blessed chair to rest this weary body." "Get him out of here," screamed the cop. Though they wouldn't admit it to Frenchy, the boys in blue were confused as to exactly what he was guilty of. A high-level conference with the public defender set them straight. He was guilty of nothing. The state cannot interfere with matters of the church. They let him go. Later in the afternoon, after having walked through startled streets, blessing the Sunday throngs, in his last ecclesiastical effort of the day, Frenchy began the weekly meeting of Veterans for Peace with a convocation just like they do at city council meetings and in Congress. "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy," he prayed, head bared of skull cap, long white hands clasped. It was one of the seven beatitudes, the same prayer he offered the disgruntled police earlier when they drove him back to the empty Church of Precious Blood where they had found him. "And bless the peacemakers, for they shall inherit the earth." And that was the Peace Cardinal. An old friend, Frenchy. And now I'd like to read a poem by Arthur Honeyman, who died 2 years ago on December 8th. And many of you knew who he was, and perhaps many of you don't. He wrote this poem in 1980, Family Weaver. Her being combs and cards each blood strand ready for the warp. She probes, pulls, and genetically cohesives the family matrix into an elan vital, woven of bloodlines and strands of DNA, communicating a transcendental vitality based on natural selection. The original birth of giving runs deep in her. The giver, the weaver, sustains, cajoles, and knits her family fabric. Experienced hairs from her skull weaves the web of family flesh. "Blood's thicker than water," shrieks her soul. The objectivity in her ultra-emotional self produces a deadpan aura. "Christmas is for children," her ancient wisdom affirms a child's faith. Grandma gives the children a moment of innocence. Thus, family ties are woven into a fiber of genetic strength. For one space in time, Grandma becomes grandchild. She shines, breathing soul, giving animation into everything around her. I observe her at work, weaving, giving, enlightening me, as my love and newfound understanding is translated into joyous tears. Because now I know, occasionally, a family weaver comes along. And Arthur wrote that Christmas, 1980. And he died more or less of respiratory collapse in Seattle. And those of you who knew Arthur knew of him as a person who, with cerebral palsy, fought all his life for the rights of physically and mentally handicapped persons. And he was one hell of a writer and a good poet. This has been Michael McCusker. Happy solstice, Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy holidays.
Michael McCusker is away for the holidays visiting family. The preceding was an encore presentation of A Story Told.